Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, May 22, 2019, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show. My guest today should be more than familiar to anyone who listens to this podcast. It's the great Charles Johnson from LittleGreenFootballs.com. Not to be confused with alt-right weirdo Chuck C. Johnson. Charles, not Chuck, owns and operates Little Green Footballs, but he's also an accomplished software engineer and guitarist, having performed and toured with legends such as Al Jarreau and Stanley Clarke. In addition to talking music, we'll talk with Charles about impeachment, Fox News, the 2020 election, Robert Mueller, and so much more. If you like what you hear, by the way, please support this show by subscribing at BobSeskaShow.com. And now let's welcome back to the show my friend, Charles Johnson.
The fan in my computer has started to make noise recently.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and of course you've got probably some sort of gigantic set of fans.
Well, it's a Mac Pro, so yeah. Okay. It's cool. Got a fan that you can hear when it starts to get going.
Charles Johnson has lots of fans, that's for sure.
I've got a really big fan here.
Yeah, but not a single one of them can take their top off. See, that's the problem. You need to get yourself some fans that can at least, I'm kidding, of course.
Yeah, those days are gone.
Did you have that kind of thing? Was that kind of your experience as you were touring with Stanley Clarke and Al Jarreau and all these guys? Did you have that kind of rock star experience?
You know, by the time I was touring with Stanley and Al Jarreau, it was that era was pretty much over.
Yeah, really.
Because, you know, AIDS came in and people were getting paranoid about the whole free sex thing.
Yeah, and you're talking about what era specifically? Like
you
the
know,
90s
the
or 80s, the
80s? Yeah, 80s and 90s, you know, when people were starting to get leery of that whole thing.
Well, I can see the 90s where people kind of cleaned up a little bit, but the 80s, it seems like the 80s was just the party decade.
It was kind of, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of partying going on.
Yeah. So
what can I tell you?
You guys had to have had some groupies and people following you around and stuff like that, no?
It was more, that happened more in the earlier days, like when I was touring with George Duke.
Oh, wow.
In the 70s.
In the 70s. Wow. You know what? I've never actually asked you, how old a guy are you?
I'm about a million. that's what it feels like lately. But actually, I'm 66.
You got to be kidding me. You are 66.
Yeah.
For some reason, I was thinking, and I don't know why I was thinking this, because you were touring when I was like 8 years old. So I was always thinking that you were the same age as me, generally, maybe around 50, maybe between 50, 55 at the very most, but 66. Yeah. How does it feel to be a 66-year-old guy with all of these experiences behind you? I mean, with like almost a Renaissance man kind of set of experiences and adventures throughout life.
That's an interesting question. you know, some of it's some of it is good to recall, some of it isn't, you know?
Yeah.
So, like a lot of the experiences I had in the music business, I wouldn't really call them terrific.
Yeah, really?
I did have some really good ones, but I also had some really bad ones. So,
I mean, was this, what kind of experiences were bad? I mean, I've had a little bit of teeny tiny experience. I had one toe in the music industry for a period of time where I was doing music videos. And well, that was more than enough time in the music industry, because as screwed up as television and movies are, seems to me as if the music industry is like 1,000 times more screwed up.
Yeah, you kind of encounter a lot of shady characters. it's especially when you start to get into it on the level where people are making real money from it.
Yeah, yeah.
And for example, I mean, I was with a band called for a while.
Yeah.
Which is one of those really great bands that just, for some reason, didn't get popular.
Interesting.
They had three records. A Bobby Columbia of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Wow.
Was the producer, actually. Not Earth, Wind, and Fire. Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I always get those two mixed up.
anyway, they did three albums. And for the third album, I had been playing with them and doing touring and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I did the second album with them as a sideman. I came in and, you know, they had already been doing tracks, and I came in and added parts. And then I kind of became part of the band.
Yeah.
After that. And when we did the third album, I collaborated with the two main guys in the band on several songs for the record.
Wow.
You know, I wrote quite a bit of, in fact, one of the songs was pretty much entirely written by me with the lyrics by them. So
nice.
You know, I mean, I had like, I think there were three, maybe four songs on the record that I had co-written. One of them didn't make it on the record, but what they did, they had made a deal with their publishing company where they got a large advance on this record.
Yeah.
And the deal was that they were going to deliver to the publishing company several, you know, an album's worth of songs, all written by them. But they had collaborated with me and a couple of other people, too. Like Kenny Loggins co-wrote one song with them.
Wow.
So, you know, they were in a position where they couldn't meet their deal with their publishing company. And they'd already gotten an advance on it.
Oh, no.
So what they tried to do was they tried to muscle me out of my publishing. They basically came to me one day and just said, you know, we really need you to, you know, to give us the publishing on this. And remember, we're giving you a lot of exposure, and, you know, you're going to get, you know, all kinds of opportunities from this and this kind of stuff. And by this point, you know, I'd been around the block a few times already, and I knew bullshit when I heard it. So, you know, it was really it turned into a big nightmare where we got lawyers.
Yeah. Well, it seems like that happens so often, and it really all comes down to the publishing, right? Because that's where the real money is.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's where the money comes from, and they had gotten an advance, so they, you know, they were kind of in a hole, and they, you know, and they made a stupid decision to co-write songs in spite of the fact that they got this publishing advance. Of course, there was a lot of cocaine flowing around then, so that may have influenced their irrational decisions.
Yeah,
But the weird thing is that I had considered these guys more than just band members. They were like close personal friends.
Right, right.
Up to that point. And to see the way they just kind of turned on a dime and, you know, tried to screw me out of something that I worked hard to do.
Yeah.
That's what I mean when I say some of the memories are not really great from the music business.
Well, yeah, it sounds like it. But it sounds like it's fairly typical. Like, it seems like every musician goes through some sort of battle over whether it's publishing or whether they get an even share of the profits for gigging and recording and so on. And But in this case, it seems like that's the most rampant and egregious thing that anyone can experience, writing music,
right?
You know, knowing that you'll get credit for this particular song or series of songs on a record, and then therefore you'll get royalties from ASCAP and BMI and all those guys for the publishing and the real, real money, apart from what you get from the label,
right?
And apart you get what you get from touring. This is kind of, you know, publishing is what you get in perpetuity for, in some cases, decades and decades and decades, right?
Yeah, correct. And it's really it's the only aspect of like songwriting that you can give away, that
right.
you can make bargains with, and like, because copyright is, you know, that's yours. Mm-hmm. Nobody can take it from you. You know, and in fact, you don't even really have to file a copyright.
Yeah.
But for publishing, it's negotiable.
Right.
And so, I mean, I've known so many musicians who worked with famous people who, you know, insisted that if they wrote a part of a song or something like that, that they had to give, if not all the publishing, at least a large chunk of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Quincy Jones is famous for this. Michael Jackson did it all the time.
Sure. You
know, everybody who worked with Michael Jackson basically gave up their publishing to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, in that case, it's almost, you know, there's almost a reason to do it because there's so much, you know, additional money coming in from other sources when you work on an album like that, that, mm-hmm. that, you know, you kind of have an incentive to do it.
Right, right.
But with the guys, you know, I didn't have any incentive to just give it to them because they wanted it, you know. Anyway.
Is this something that I can include in the show? Because obviously we're already starting to chat here. Can I include it but bleep out or something like that?
I guess you could, yeah, maybe we can, make it about an anonymous band that I worked with a long time ago.
Okay, I'll do that.
Not everybody is like that. I don't want to give you that impression. You know, a lot of, like George Duke, for example, the big tune that I co-wrote with him was Reach For It.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually started as a jam in the studio. We
wow.
were just jamming. And, you know, he actually gave the other musicians in the band, it was myself, the bass player and the drummer, and Dugu Chancellor and Byron Miller, the publishing. He gave us equal shares of the publishing on the tune. He didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, not everybody's like that. Some people are decent, some aren't, you know.
So going back to what I was originally mentioning about you when we first started chatting here is the fact that you are really very much a Renaissance man. You have a wide spectrum of things that you do, everything from being a master on guitar all the way up to programming for Little Green Footballs and keeping tabs on politics and so on. Mm-hmm. When you were a touring musician, when you were a recording musician, how did you kill all of that spare time that you have in that kind of situation?
That's actually how I began learning about programming
computers. Oh, really?
Because this is back in the, when did this start? I think it was the late 70s or early 80s that I was working with Al Jarreau.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he was not touring very much, so I had a lot of time at home. And one of the things I did just to, you know, spend some time, I bought an Atari computer. And I bought it mainly to play games on, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which one, though? What, you didn't buy this? You're not talking about the 2600. You're talking about like an actual desktop Atari machine.
No, the 400 originally.
Right.
And then the 800 later. But what it had a cartridge system where you plug cartridges into the top of the thing.
Oh, yeah. I remember those.
And they had a lot of game cartridges, but they also had a basic language cartridge.
Hmm, interesting.
And I went one day, I just started fooling around with that, and I got into it because it was almost, in a way, it's like music or sculpture or something. You know, mm-hmm. you build something and you can keep working on it and making it better.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, it's an attractive thing for creative people, I think. I know a lot of musicians who got into computers on one level or another.
Yeah, there's,
you know,
something that's I don't know how else to describe it. There's something that's constructive about it where you're, you know, it's almost like writing a screenplay where you're figuring out or a song for that matter, just going back to your actual metaphor of this, it's very much
right.
like music where you've got sort of a basic structure that maybe you jam and you go through and you make a quick tape of that, and then you're building, you're constantly building and revising and moving things around, and especially now with things like Pro Tools and so on. But even back then, people would do a lot of editing with razor blades and tape and so on, and it's the same kind of process. You're constantly refining, and with programming, it seems to me as if you're always going back and solving little problems, little conundrums along the way, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, man, now there's a dog barking.
Is that your dog?
Window. No, that's some dog outside. Somebody's walking it, I think.
A random dog outside.
Somebody's walking it. They're going past now.
Right.
Just a loud dog.
That's become a feature on my Wednesday show. Whoever I'm talking to, there's always some sort of chaos happening behind it. I talked to Malcolm Nance a couple of weeks ago, and I think the second time I interviewed him, he was getting off an airplane and going to like a baggage claim and getting his rental car and everything, all while we're talking on the podcast. So it was a lot of fun to get the behind the scenes Malcolm Nance. So, but anyway.
Okay, I think the dog has gone away.
Sounds good. But anyway, so we're talking about programming and how you made that segue from from just doing it kind of in your spare time into something that became more of the central focus, right?
You know, if I hadn't been in a band that wasn't touring enough to keep me busy, I probably never would have gotten into programming. But I had months at a time where I wasn't doing much. You know, I was staying at home, and you can't take other gigs because they want to tour on a moment's notice, you know, and you could lose the band. So anyway, it ended up being something that I kind of had an affinity for, and I got deeper and deeper into it and learned machine language programming, assembly language, and eventually got really good at it and ended up starting a company to market utility software that I wrote. So
that was sort of your second chapter, right? You start out as a touring and recording musician, and then you move on to starting your own software company.
I was still touring through all this. I mean, I actually had a travel case made for an Atari computer.
Oh, wow.
That I actually brought on the road with me. Yeah. People thought I was nuts. probably was.
Oh, well, they probably hadn't seen anything like that ever before. At least like in the early 80s, everyone was thinking, oh, computers are basically what we see in arcades, and then maybe the Atari 2600, or I think Intellivision existed at that point. But
there were no laptop computers. This was like the size of a suitcase, you know?
Oh, my God, yeah.
It had a giant disk drive in it, you know, one of those floppy disk drives.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my first computer like that was a Commodore 64, where I had the 6-inch floppy disks that we used to just pirate the hell out of them. Because if you had a friend who had a disk drive, like the Commodore 64 disk drive, you could just do almost like a tape-to-tape kind of thing, like putting two boom boxes next to each other and recording one off the other. And you could do the same thing with a Commodore 64 disk drive. So the pirating of software was all over the place at that time. That's what I remember.
Oh, yeah. I did my share of that until I formed a company, and then I was very opposed to it.
That's the way it always happens. Like, I was really, like, around the year 2000, when Napster was really popular, I did a cartoon about Metallica and their approach toward, when they sued Napster, and I did a cartoon making fun of them. And so I became almost like a poster boy for Napster and for music sharing and so on. And then I actually started making other cartoons in my animation studio, and I suddenly became pounding my fist on the desk going, "Don't steal my work." And it's funny how you end up seeing both sides of that argument, you know.
Yeah, you do if you get into it. And a lot of people have seen that, you know. But but nowadays it's really the whole system. There's no, you know, I mean, it's really changed. Everything is delivered over the internet now, and you know, and it's a lot easier to sort of maintain your intellectual property because you can force people to log in and sign in and all that kind of stuff before they can even use anything. So,
well, even the music industry too. I mean, almost as much as computer technology and the internet and so on, the music industry, and this actually, you can weave this into a discussion of Napster and everything else. The music industry has entirely changed. And I don't think it's necessarily landed yet. I don't think anyone really knows where the music industry is going from here, because there are so many platforms now, so many people making it on their own, independent music and so on, alternative music, all seems to be in some sort of phantom zone right now where it's kind of everyone for themselves.
Yeah, and it's become a system where you really don't, I mean, you can't really make money through recordings very much anymore, because they're so easy to, you know, share around and whatever. And streaming services are just ripping off artists like ridiculously.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost giving them 10th of a cent for a listen and that kind of stuff, or even less in some cases. So
yeah. Well, it's the exact opposite of when you came up through music, where at that time, the albums and recordings drove the money of the music industry, where touring was just a side thing that you would do just to promote your record. But now it's exactly the opposite, where the touring is where all the money is, and the records are the ones that get pirated and passed around and just thrown out there as almost its own little promotional value-added thing on the side. It's kind of strange how that is now, where the product is really the concert, and the what used to be the product is now the peripheral, you know, like a bonus feature that you get on the DVD or something. You know what I mean?
It's your exposure. I mean, that's it's all about exposure for, you know, recordings these days. And it does do that job, because if people like something, they'll share it. You know, it gets on YouTube, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. I mean, the it's been very stratified in recent years, where you've got the top pop stars who are, like, put out a record and it instantly sells 10 million copies, you know, and then you have everybody else, and the music business itself is all about those top pop stars now. They don't take chances on anybody.
Right.
You know, back when I was coming up, they used to take chances. They used to let you do a few records that don't make money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you wouldn't lose your deal immediately, you know.
Right.
These days they expect your first record to make money or see ya.
Yeah, it's so sad when I think about it in those terms, because you know, there was such a high watermark that occurred, and it was a really, really high watermark. Unless you actually witnessed it and experienced it, it's really difficult to underscore how amazing the 70s were for music, as far as music freedom and recording artists being allowed to kind of do whatever they want, and being able to develop an audience over two or three or maybe even upwards of five albums before there's actually a big hit.
It was a real free-for-all, you know, in a lot of ways, and nobody knew what was going to happen. But, you know, you're right. It was basically the rise of Napster that put an end to so much of that.
Yes, yes. And I feel partly responsible for that myself. Yeah, again, I tend to be so ambivalent about it. Like, some things I'm like, don't steal that. And other things, I was like, well, it's not stealing, it's sharing. It's so I feel so conflicted about the entire issue.
Yeah, it is. It's not an easy one, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that makes it difficult is just the simplicity of you know, sharing things.
Yeah.
It's not hard at all these days.
Right.
You can share anything. I mean, what I can't share, like music that I get off of Apple Music, for example, you can't share that. And they've got that pretty locked down.
Yeah.
So,
well, I figured out a way. I don't know. I don't know if it's actually legal or not, but I can just drag files out of iTunes and drop them right into my recording software, like Sony SoundForge or something like that.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then, you can do it that way. You can also, I have a program that records sound that's playing on the computer.
Oh, yeah.
So
you
could do it that way too.
Yeah. So, I'm still running Windows 7. You can do that in Windows 7 just using the audio settings. It's
right.
Interesting
there's
as well as
frustrating.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, how's everything at Little Green Footballs? You know, I think people don't really realize, but you've built one hell of a gigantic community there. How many active users do you have at this point?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I haven't even looked in quite a while. You know, it's probably a few hundred.
I mean, do you think that part of the reason why you've been able to sustain Little Green Footballs for so long is because of the community you've built there? Because it's not just your blog. It's you have a kind of a community blog where anyone can start their own page, which I think is an ingenious way of constantly generating content.
Yeah, it's that definitely helps, you know.
Yeah.
it really, it's gotten, you know, this is another situation where things have changed a lot for blogging, you know, and again, it was a technological innovation that kind of kicked things off into the new era. It was Twitter and Facebook that pretty much killed blogging.
Right. And you're kind of like me though, right? Because I see you much more often or being more present in terms of presenting your opinions about what's going on with Trump and the news and so on, more in the format of Twitter rather than writing blogs like you used to.
Yeah, I mean, well, you kind of have to. I mean, this one of the, you can't ignore Facebook and Twitter. You know, I wish I could.
I know, me too.
But I am kind of ignoring Facebook lately, though, because they've made a bunch of changes lately in the way their APIs work.
Yeah,
that make it really hard to automatically share articles that you post at a blog.
Yeah.
And it's a pain in the butt to try to get it to work because you have to jump through so many hoops to get this OAuth authorization working with them. And it's
What exactly is it that you're trying to do? For the people who aren't exactly sure APIs are.
When I write a blog post, for example, I used to have it set up where it would automatically, as soon as I posted it to the blog, it would go share it on Twitter and on my Facebook page, right?
Yeah.
But lately, the Facebook page they've changed things, so it actually I haven't even checked it lately. But when they first made the change, it just wouldn't work at all. There was no way to make it work. They just removed the functionality. I don't know if they put back some of it now because a lot of people were screaming about it. Developers were going, "What are you doing? there's hundreds of thousands of people out here who use this feature."
Yeah. I mean, it's one of many things that people are screaming about with regard to Facebook. Have you been impacted by the shifting algorithms and the throttling of people's traffic?
I got to be honest, I've always hated Facebook.
Yeah,
always. I know. From the very first time I was on it, just even the look of it makes my skin crawl. It's terrible looking. It's like an institutional building with some kind of weird, muted dark blue color, and I always think I'm like in a hospital or something.
Yeah, and good luck changing your settings on Facebook because from what I can see, that there are a million different ways to get to some form of settings for your own presence on Facebook, and I can never find what I'm looking for on Facebook. As far as like if I want to change my privacy settings or change passwords or something like that, it's always a process of hunting for wherever the hell you do that.
And that's on purpose.
Is it really?
I'm sure it's deliberate. Yeah, because what they're trying to do is make it hard for you to, keep them out of your business.
Yeah,
you know, they want to get all up in your business.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Facebook is. That's what it's always been.
Yeah.
And if they make it hard for you to find, they can say we put in this feature where you can stop us from seeing what advertisements you look at. But good luck trying to find it.
Exactly.
And if you go searching for it and you don't find it in like 5 minutes, most people just give up.
It always seems to me as if they're just fucking with us. Like Mark Zuckerberg treats Facebook as his own personal ant farm. And every once in a while, he grabs the ant farm and shakes it all up just to watch all the ants scurry all around and wonder what the fuck is going on.
Yeah, he's playing at social engineering, and Twitter is, to a certain extent, Twitter does that too. They're not quite as prying into everybody's business, but they, every time I hear Jack Dorsey talk about, healthy conversations and how they're going to use algorithms to enable healthy conversations, I want to scream because that's just bullshit, man.
Yeah.
It's never going to work.
Yeah.
It is never going to work. And he thinks that that's a substitute for, getting rid of bad elements, because he doesn't want to take the risk of being seen as the bad guy.
Yeah, I know.
The drill sergeant who stepped in and made things, a different way.
Yeah.
But unless you do that, it will always be shit. And I know this from experience because Little Green Footballs was shit like that at one point.
I had to step in. Yeah, you had to step in and start doing it yourself, right? Because there probably wasn't a blogging platform that was acceptable to you, at least from looking at it from a back-end point of view, right?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, when Little Green Footballs was known as a right-wing blog.
Oh, right.
And there came a point where I realized that a lot of the people who were frequenting the blog were people I wouldn't want to be with in real life.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
And, yeah, and so, I mean, there was a time where I just started making it clear that I wasn't down with a lot of this social conservative bullshit that was that was starting to rise up even more powerfully.
Yeah.
And a lot of people bailed on me at that point. A lot of people just quit and, you know, left long ranting messages about why they were doing it. We used to call them the flounce messages. But, you know, it's and then I had to just block a lot of people. I had to suspend accounts and, you know, because I realized I needed to change the direction because it had gotten too crazy, you know. And it's funny because, you know, in my entire life as a musician and, you know, whatever, even growing up, going to college, I was never a right winger.
Yeah.
I was always a very liberal person politically and, you know, socially, whatever. And I never believed a lot of that crap. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, what happened was I got kind of pulled into it.
Yeah.
After 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And that event really affected me, you know, emotionally.
Yeah, yeah. As it did with a lot of us. I think a lot of us were impacted, not only in terms of PTSD, but I think there were some people who were very left-wing before 9/11, and 9/11 radicalized them as far as war and retaliation for that attack, right?
I think it did that to me for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I know it did. And, you know, part of it was anger, but also I wanted to understand more about it. And one of the reasons I started getting into the blog more was to share information about radical Islam with people, just to kind of enlighten as many people as I could about what was going on, because, you know, they had just killed a whole lot of people in New York, and I wanted to understand what was going on more than just being angry about it. And that was actually kind of the impetus that got it started. But, you know, I mean, I had to face up to the fact that it had turned into something that I didn't want it to be.
Yeah.
And there was a point where I just had to make a break, and I did.
That was so brave of you, I think, because I would be so hesitant to do that, to make such a radical shift out of fear of basically losing everything I had worked for. And I think there are a lot of people who are in the same boat. So it can't be highlighted enough how bold a move that was for you to say, you know what, this Tea Party thing is completely out of control. I never signed on for this. I don't want to be the platform for these ideas. So bye-bye, no more. If you're interested in this shit, go somewhere else, right?
That's kind of, you know, in a way, that's been the story of my life. I've always done that if something is not going the way I think it really needs to, for whatever reason, I don't play along. You know, I've always been kind of, I guess, a lone wolf in that way. But on the other hand, it really ends up where I don't have to, you know, I mean, I do look back on some things with regret, but I can honestly say I didn't, you know, compromise principles when it really counted.
And ultimately it worked because you were able to, I don't even think it was a matter of rebuilding. You were just able to kind of phase out one aspect of your audience as you were phasing in a new aspect of it. Is that how it worked?
Kind of, yeah. Just by keeping on, you know, by still doing what I wanted to do and writing what I wanted to write and saying what I needed to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are still people out there who really hate me from those days too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, not only left-wingers who hated what I was writing back then, but some of the people that got suspended from the blog are like obsessively following everything I do these days. And still, for years and years, they've been at it.
I know the feeling. Yeah. I know those kind of people. I'm familiar with those kind of people. I unfortunately have my own group of those kind of people. And, you know, it's to me, you know, one of the many ways that I relate to you and your work, Charles, is the fact that that you are intellectually honest, that you stand by your ideas, that you're not changing your views views on the world. You're not changing your attitudes on certain issues based on what the popular thing is at that point in time. And I always go back to when we first started communicating with each other on Twitter specifically during the entire Snowden Greenwald thing. And and that was a case where even though we were both ensconced in liberal conversation on blogs and so on, we kind of took an approach that was counter to what a lot of liberals were saying at that point in time. And I think we generated some enemies in that process on our own side.
Yeah. And in fact, some of the enemies I generated were people who were starting to think maybe I was okay after that right-wing episode, you know. Yeah. But something about that whole thing just never smelled right to me, and it just I couldn't just be quiet about it, you know. I mean, I made one comment to Glenn Greenwald and he blocked me instantly. So, you know,
because he's so brave and he has such courage of his convictions that he's just got to block anyone who injects a little bit of truth and honesty into what he's saying.
Yeah. And then he'll go and attack you, you know, from behind the block periodically.
The worst. So Dan Bongino of him. That's another thing that Dan Bongino does.
It's because he knows that if he does it, he'll get a whole lot of people to harass you.
Exactly.
That's why he's doing it.
Yeah, and you know,
and it's a sleazy thing to do, really.
I think we may have talked about this on the podcast before, but am I the only one kind of looking at what happened in 2013 with Snowden as sort of a testing ground for Russia as far as...
Oh, no,
as...
you're not the only one. I've been thinking the same thing. It's really, it's kind of interesting to see that now, to look back on it, and to see the way Glenn Greenwald, for example, is now pretty much, you know, supporting the Fox News audience.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's been on Tucker Carlson show over and over and over. This is not just a guy who wants to appear to maybe change a few minds. He's supporting Tucker Carlson. He really is.
Yeah. His core values are actually one value, and that one value is contrarianism. Whatever the Democrats are saying, he's going to say the opposite in the form of constantly, you know, shaking his finger and scolding them. Yeah. Because he is. That's what, bottom line, Glenn Greenwald is a professional scold.
Yeah, he is, and also a narcissist.
Yeah, well,
which
that,
is a bad
too.
Combination, you know, because most of what he does is about self promotion. Really.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it seems to me as if the Snowden thing, looking back with the context of everything that's happened with the Russian attack, I've been in fact calling it the Russian invasion more recently because it seems like that's what it is. It's an invasion of our national sovereignty. But the thing is that I think version one, maybe the beta testing version of what happened with the 2016 election and forward through to this day, kind of was, you know, kind of occurred with Edward Snowden. Like, how much can we disrupt American politics just by getting this one guy to maybe steal some documents from the NSA and then completely blow up an entire summer of the Obama administration, completely sidetrack whatever agenda Obama had lined up in lieu of having to defend the national security infrastructure of the United States.
Seems to me that was the test.
I think
you're right, man. I think you got a good outlook on that. I think there was some influence there from the same people who eventually refined these techniques. I mean, that what they did there was kind of old school espionage stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they got a guy and they, you know, convinced him to turn and, you know, not Glenn Greenwald, I'm talking about Snowden here.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, and what they did is they found one of these libertarian types. You know, who knows how they found him? I mean, he did have an online presence all over the place, you know, and he was not a nice guy in a lot of it. And he, you know, they probably identified him one way or another. And, you know, eventually he was convinced to turn. Wow. And, you know, I really don't think that he ended up in Russia accidentally at
no,
all.
No.
I don't buy that for one second.
Not at all. That was all part of the plan. In fact, you know, there's maybe a theory there insofar as maybe Edward Snowden started to do what he had planned to do with those NSA documents, and then Russia came in and kind of co-opted him. Because what happened was he went from Hawaii, Booz Allen Hamilton on Oahu, over to Hong Kong. He fled to Hong Kong.
Right.
And after a period of time in Hong Kong, and all of this is well documented, whether it's in Citizen Four or the Snowden movie or what have you, he spends some time in Hong Kong, but ends up at the end of his time in Hong Kong at the Russian consulate in Hong Kong, where they're throwing a pizza birthday party for him, only to then after that be shuttled to Moscow by WikiLeaks lawyers. And then once he gets into Russia, he's represented by a former FSB attorney, Anatoly Kucherena. And so it seems to me that's like that with WikiLeaks involved, with people linked to Russian intelligence involved, ultimately with Vladimir Putin giving Snowden asylum in Moscow. All of that crap just rings 2015, 2016, 2017, all the way up through today. The same players are kind of involved then as they are now, with minus the Trump group, which is Trump is kind
Snowden
of the new Snowden. Yeah,
those people are just a terrific weapon, because what he did is he gave them something that they could use to portray these systems as some kind of nefarious, you know,
deep state,
worldwide deep state operation that was learning everything about everybody. Mm-hmm. And it really was not that. And, I mean, yes, I do think there were some areas where the NSA oversteps their bounds.
Sure.
But you know, in general, that whole system was designed with a lot of transparency and a lot of oversight.
Yeah.
And, you know, people just don't understand that. And I understand the kind of knee-jerk reaction to being spied on.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you know, the people who exploited that know that most people will never bother to learn everything about what they're being upset about.
Yes. In fact, that's the social media internet aspect of the Snowden situation. Like, we have the social media internet aspect of the Russian attack now, but going back to 2013, what the internet did is it kind of perpetuated this frustrating level of American ignorance, where even members of Congress were entirely misrepresenting what NSA can and can't do, what the FISA courts can and can't do. Oh, by the way, yet another crossover element of the Snowden situation to today, FISA somehow being involved and demonized. That was something that was happening in 2013, too. So you have all of these nuances and all of these myriad detail. I mean, just it would take someone years, almost to the point of becoming a scholar in national security, especially foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, to understand all of those finer points of how the operation works. And people, even reporters who were reporting hard news about what was going on, didn't have a full grasp in terms of all of those details. And so it was very easy for people like Glenn Greenwald to play a shell game and to kind of mix things around in a way that presented information suiting his agenda.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that you and I both hammered on constantly. Yeah. Was the misleading nature of so much of what he was writing back then. I mean, you'd literally have to read like 27 paragraphs in to find the part that says, hey, but by the way, none of this ever happened in reality. Mm-hmm. You know?
And then today he's got the nerve to sit there in Rio and just with his monkeys and his dogs and just talk about how bad the American press is and how misleading the American press is. And he is one of the most egregious violators of the public trust when it comes to the press, because what we were observing coming out of, unfortunately, The Guardian at that time and The Guardian's leadership at that time. And since then, the leadership at The Guardian has left. They're no longer there. Glenn Greenwald's no longer there. They've all moved on. So The Guardian's kind of a different entity now. So I don't want to categorically bash The Guardian, but the reporting that was going on there was just egregiously bad. I mean, I was shocked, and we were exchanging notes.
Stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I always go back to that. Alan Rusbridger piece where he, I guess that's his last, Rusbridger. I think that was his last name.
Yeah.
Where he publishes this whole piece about Snowden and Greenwald and all of it. And then somewhere in like paragraph 30 goes, oh yeah, by the way, the GCHQ stopped by and they destroyed all of our Snowden documents and the computers they were held on. And, yeah, and here are some pictures of our MacBooks after they were bashed up by the GCHQ, which is the British NSA. And as if, first of all, the GCHQ has a goon squad, which is just kind of insane to imagine that. But at the same time, the pictures that he presented, and again, I feel like a broken record with this all the time, because I'm going, look, you see, don't you people see that, you know, the pictures that he said were MacBook parts that were bashed up by the GCHQ. Turned out it was like from some Dell computer from 1994 or something like that.
Yeah, it was a PC motherboard, yeah.
with all kinds of PC peripheral devices and things that you could see in there, too. And it was obvious to anyone who had seen inside of a computer that these were not MacBook parts. And
yeah,
and they never really did a formal correction on that, did they?
Didn't they eventually publish some pictures that were of a Mac?
Oh, you know what?
I think they did. I remember some pictures that were from a MacBook, I think.
Yeah, what they did, from what I recall, and you might be right on that, but I also remember a video that was floating around maybe 5 or 6 months after that piece dropped, which is also suspicious that, oh, we've now suddenly, look at this video we have. And it was a video of someone with like a circular saw sawing through a MacBook or something like that.
Right,
or
right.
Using like a Dremel tool and Dremeling a hard drive or something like that. And again, it was so long after the fact that you had to wonder, did they just rig this up to cover their own asses or something like that? I mean, there was no reason for me to take that at face value. I had seen enough chicanery at that point. I'm like, well, yeah, whatever, guys. If you didn't present this the day after you wrote that article with the urgency and the degree of attention that you were receiving because of all of this, then, we can't take it at face value.
Yeah, that was a bad episode, you know. It really was. Yeah. I mean, but you're right. The Guardian has actually improved quite a bit since those days. You know.
Well, even Luke Harding's reporting I've actually found quite reliable, and Luke Harding was one of the guys who was, you know, on board the Snowden train. In fact, the Oliver Stone Snowden movie is based on Luke Harding's book, and Luke Harding has been doing a lot of reporting on the Russia story, and it has been confirmed by other news outlets. So I have a little more faith in his ability. But at the time, Luke Harding was one of the guys. Remember, he said he posted some article about how the NSA was deleting his book as he was writing it.
As he was writing it, that was great. Yeah,
it was probably his delete button was stuck or something like that, which was what was going on. But
some Cheeto crumbs got stuck in the keyboard.
Yeah, exactly. And this guy's work became the basis for that Oliver Stone movie. But
I also discovered it's possible for one of his coworkers to be pranking him too. You know. USB keyboard that gets paired, you know, a Bluetooth keyboard that gets paired to that computer, you could be like in a desk, two desks away, typing this stuff and deleting it.
Yeah, that's such a great explanation. I love that one the most, in fact. Not just his key stuck down or something like that, or some sort of glitch with his computer. Someone was actually either knowingly or unknowingly screwing with his computer as he was writing.
Just the idea that the NSA is going to, you know, break into your computer and then delete things as you're typing.
Yes, which is so subtle and inconspicuous.
Yeah, sure, that's how the NSA works. You know what I mean? It's like cartoonish, really.
Right, right. Well, speaking of cartoonish, did you see Trump's news conference this morning?
I didn't actually see it, but I've been reading about it.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to whining and denying and playing his whole who me routine, which is getting really, really old at this point. I can't believe anyone, his supporters or enemies alike, aren't entirely sick and tired of just, oh, who me? Who me? I didn't do anything.
The guilt is so obvious at this point. Oh, my God. You know, if you had a friend who was talking like this, who was accused of something, you wouldn't believe him. For a second, you know, I don't know why people are willing to cut him a break.
It's so obvious because, I mean, what he did is he staged this whole thing where he got Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to come up to the Oval to talk about infrastructure, and then he deliberately walked out of it and then directly out into the Rose Garden where they had already set up his podium. And a piece of poster board that said all of the statistics from the Mueller report, like
right, yeah.
The number of witnesses who were interviewed, the cost of the report, everything was all set up as if it was, and if anyone is looking at it going, oh, well, the explanation is actually how it happened, well, you're out to lunch, because that's not, he meant for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to show up so he could walk out on them and right. make a big fucking deal over, you know, no collusion or whatever else he's screaming.
He's literally running the government as if it were some kind of, you know, preschool with him as the only student.
Yeah. Well, what happens is, I mean, if you end up with the CEO president, you know, everyone who's been screaming for the last two decades about how we need someone who runs a business to come in and run the country like they're running a business. Well, here's the consequence of that. What you end up having is a CEO president who's using all the levers of the executive branch of government in order to enrich himself and to help himself rather than yeah. to be a steward of democracy and a steward of good government and legislation and so on.
Right.
Yeah. So
he's not a normal CEO either. This is a CEO's, you know, mob connected.
Yeah, exactly. He's completely corrupt. Yeah.
Yeah. And his whole family is just as corrupt. I mean, right. literally. Another thing that amazes me lately is, you know, people are going, hey, Don Jr. just retweeted a white nationalist, Stephen Molyneux. And I'm going, haven't you been paying attention? And the guy has been openly associating with white nationalists for yeah. years now. I mean, it's been in the news. How can you be surprised by this at this point? You know, this is what they do. This is who they are.
Earlier today, you tweeted, one of these days, Trump is going to have a major breakdown of some kind in public. And it's going to be epic. All of the bad craziness we've seen so far is just a warm up. I couldn't agree with you more. And you know what? That's why I watch his rallies. That's why I watch these press conferences, because I'm either waiting for the stroke or I'm waiting for him to just go nuts and have that major breakdown you're talking
for
about.
For that moment when he, you know, strips off all his clothes. Starts babbling about lizard people or something, you know,
just humping one of the columns in the colonnade next to the Rose Garden or something obnoxious like that. Yeah, I'm just waiting. I mean, Patton Oswalt always talks about it. I'm just waiting for Trump to take his dick out at any point in time. That's going to, he's just going to take it out, and that's going to be good luck watching Lou Dobbs that night. Well, the president has a mighty fine penis, and we just got to see it today because he's a true American.
This penis is a penis that rules countries.
That is America's penis right there, ladies and gentlemen. But you, actually, this morning, I mean, we almost got it. We almost got the meltdown today, or the stroke, and he had more trouble with his mouth again.
Yeah, that's been happening a lot lately.
Yeah,
increasingly.
And I'm seeing the reaction more and more become, oh, this is a consequence of drugs and less a consequence of some sort of physical episode that he's that's happening just naturally, or his teeth or something like that. You know, people are going, oh, I see it now. I used to use, you know, cocaine or whatever, you know. So this is, he's having a reaction to some sort of cognitive enhancer here, whether it's Adderall or Provigil or what have you.
It looks like that. I mean, it's possible. It's also, I mean, the guy is, he's getting up there in years, and you know, I think his mind is coming apart slowly. I mean, really, if you go back and listen to him 10, 20 years ago, listen to recordings of him, he didn't sound this insane.
Right.
He really didn't. I mean, he still was a jerk and an asshole, but
this is why not just anyone can run for president or be president, because you have to have an inhuman level of physical and emotional stamina that, while Trump talks about his amazing stamina, I don't think he really has. I don't think he's really cut out to only sleep 4 hours a night and eat nothing but hamburgers and to be constantly on an up and down roller coaster, whether it's, you know, he's popping whatever before he does these rallies and whatever before he does these press conferences. And that's got to mess with him physically. So I look at him and I go, and this is not out of some morbid curiosity necessarily, or maybe a little bit of it is, but at the same time, I feel like he can't continue like this as a healthy person, or as a quote unquote healthy person, with the way he abuses himself.
And you can see that the guy is under enormous stress. I mean, when he gets on Twitter at 6 a.m. and posts 14 tweets in a row ranting about witch hunt and, you know, no collusion and all that stuff, mm-hmm. he's in it right now. Yeah. He's living in hell.
Yeah.
Which is where he belongs, by the way.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And I hope he gets there. I hope at some point soon. And I hope it's a living hell. I hope it's one of these things where, you know, much like, well, there are lots of people in history who have lived on in infamy where no one wants to be associated with their names anymore. And I hope Donald Trump is one of those people moving forward. The people just don't. The name Trump just becomes like the name Hitler or the name Mussolini, and we just say, oh, or Nixon, you know. It's like we don't want to be attached to this name, this brand anymore, and I hope that's what
happens. How do we get these Democrats to start, you know, finding their spines again?
I was just going to ask you that. Like, why do you think the Democrats are so terrified of impeachment at this point? Well, I'm just saying, they're starting to come around. I don't want to completely indict them on this front, but there are a few Democrats who are still, I keep comparing them to, like, Barney Fife in a haunted house. They're just like quivering bowls of jello, and they don't know what to do next. Like, oh my God, we never anticipated that Trump was actually going to, you know, break the law.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they probably have a point that the Senate won't convict.
Yeah.
They probably won't. I mean, even if, you know, they have hearings and everything and the whole impeachment proceeding takes place and all the information is put out in front, they're still going to be, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see all the Republicans of the Senate refuse to convict anyway, even when they know, because they're like pigs in shit right now. Mm-hmm. You know, they're enjoying this power so much, and it's got them by the nads, really.
Yeah, and even though
they're not going to give it up willingly,
right? And even though they are not winning, they feel like they are winning. And I think that's all that matters. That's what gets telegraphed to their voters. And if their voters feel like that their leaders are winning, if voters feel like their messiahs are accomplishing what they need to accomplish as far as owning the libs, then they're happy about that.
Well, one way that they are winning is they're installing hundreds of federal judges.
Yeah.
At the behest of the Federalist Society, which is, you know, extremely far right organization that has been working for years on building the systems to put these people in place. And these are lifetime appointments. So, you know, they are winning in some ways. And the longer Trump is allowed to just keep doing what he does, the worse it's going to get, because every day they're pushing more of these judges into office. So
how do we get the Democrats, and I'm just talking about voters now, how do we, because really if Democratic voters actually voted and had the same level of enthusiasm every election, the Democrats would basically control politics, and the Republicans, as they're, I think intended to be, the Republicans would be relegated just being the permanent opposition party. And to me, that's the permanent state of things. In fact, David Frum agrees that should be the permanent state of things, where the Democrats govern and the Republicans are over on the side, kind of making sure things don't get too out of hand, but they're just, you know, the permanent opposition party and doing what an opposition party does. So,
man, that would be paradise, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, how do we get to that point? Because it seems like the Democrats are plagued by this, oh, don't hit me, don't punch me too hard, I don't know if I can take the punching. And
that's the Democrat Party, and then the base is too lackadaisical about their responsibility to vote. You know, I mean, one way to do it would be to do what some countries do and require voting.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
You know, and I do think that, I mean, if we can require jury duty in order to vote, maybe we should also require voting.
Well, for God's sake, we had the draft for how many decades, you know, where it was unpopular, of course, but at the same time, it was still a draft where the government could say, not just, oh, on Tuesday, you have to go down and cast a ballot. They were saying, oh, on Tuesday, you have to go to your draft board, and then you have to be sent to Vietnam and murdered by, you know, so on. And so obviously the problem of mandatory voting is not nearly as severe as some other things that have been compulsory in this country.
Yeah, requiring people to spend a few hours on one day of a year, you know, maybe even just every 4 years. You know? I mean, that's not quite like being forced to go into the military for 4 years.
Yeah. Well, I think if there's one positive side effect out of what what happened in 2016 is that I think a lot of Democrats are beginning to realize what happens when they either stay home or when they vote for a third party or when they just allow someone who's quite clearly a despot to rise to power just because they're not particularly enthused about their Democratic nominee. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's there's a hard lesson that I think is going to be learned, or at least I'm hoping is going to be learned out of this, so we don't repeat the same mistake with Susan Sarandon and all these others, these contrarians.
I think part of the problem, honestly, is also that you know, bad people with bad aims will spend all their time trying to make those aims come true.
Yeah.
Whereas people, you know, like a lot of liberals want to live their lives. Mm-hmm. they don't want to work at politics all the time. But these right-wing groups are constantly working at this.
Yeah.
You know, and most people aren't even aware of what they're doing, but it's 24/7 with these people.
Mm-hmm. Are you as frustrated with Robert Mueller as I am?
Yeah. I think I probably am because, you know, and for one thing, he should have been out there after releasing the report, you know, backing it up and talking about it.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why he hasn't been. It's there's something odd about the whole thing.
Yes. And you know what? I have several theories along these lines. Everything from kind of the remote possibility that maybe there's just something physically wrong with Robert Mueller, that making a public appearance is going to somehow embarrass him. Maybe he's not, because he is getting up there too. And you know, I don't know. He's had health problems in the past. I think he had prostate cancer there for a while. And so everything from that all the way to the Sarah Kendzior thing, which is to say that Robert Mueller is compromised. I'm not going to go that far by any stretch, but I do think that he is shirking his duty at this point as someone who has been our Elliot Ness in this, but is now not, or now is refusing to rise to the occasion after his report has dropped. And he's left so much ambiguity in there. One of the most frustrating things has been what's happened in the past 24 hours, which is news coming out saying that Robert Mueller is concerned about looking political, and so therefore his testimony in Congress should be behind closed doors. And right. I figure, you know, this guy left the ramifications of his report up to Congress. He handed this report off to Congress, especially the obstruction charges. And so now he's complaining about his report looking too political. He gave this to Congress. He made this. If there is a political element to this, he made this political, right? By leaving this up to Congress.
Well, he's never been like a real public kind of person, has he? I mean, it's not, he's never been in the public eye a lot.
Well, he has, but he has testified on many occasions, and I think he's held some press conferences, especially after, because he was FBI director on 9/11.
Right, but not in situations where he's going to get attacked and raked over the coals by Fox News. You know, I mean, I think
that's true.
Part of it may also just be not wanting to go through all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because anybody who testifies right now in this matter is going to be, you know, I mean, it's going to be a feeding frenzy.
Yeah. But it seems like he should know. He should know better than that. That regardless of what he does, Fox News is going to attack him. And sometimes taking a stand with regard to, you know, having the courage of your convictions and saying this is a report, this is on the level. And, you know, but
I wouldn't say that as an excuse for him. Yeah. I don't think that's a reason for him not to do it. But I think maybe that's part of what he's calculating, you know, that he just doesn't want to go through all that crap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a way, I can't blame him. But in another way, it's his duty. He needs to.
Right. Well, do you believe the pundits who suggest Trump wants this impeachment fight? Do you think that Trump is looking for a battle along these lines, or that he's terrified of it?
No, I don't. I think he's terrified.
Yep, me too.
I think he does not want an impeachment. I think that would be, I mean, for him, his whole narcissistic, self-glorifying fantasy depends on being the guy who was the best president ever. You know, and impeachment kind of throws a little monkey wrench into that.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Like, and there's this conventional wisdom growing that, you know, and I think this is one of the reasons why the Democrats are afraid of taking him on with an impeachment proceeding, is that, oh, he wants this battle. He's looking for it so he can say fake news and he can say, look at crazy Nancy. Yeah. crying Chuck or whatever, and this is what this is the kind of thing he does. But I tend to disagree with that. I think when the shit really hits the fan, Donald Trump ultimately is a coward. Like, he's been talking a lot about treason lately. Now, if he actually saw real treason surrounding him, he would take action. He's the commander in chief. He's the president of the United States. If he sees some sort of egregious laws being violated, rising to the level of treason, then he would pursue that. But I don't get the sense that he is, because he's too afraid of maybe blowback, or maybe it not showing what he claims is there, and then him getting, you know, but I don't know if that's necessarily stopped him in the past. But regardless, he's not willing to go that extra step, or at least to this point, he hasn't gone that far.
I think you're right. I think he's basically a coward, like most bullies are.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't make them any less powerful as bullies, but it explains a lot of what they do, you know, and I think Trump is a coward. I think he's afraid of dealing with these consequences.
Yeah.
He had some fantasy that he would come into office and everybody would love him. I mean, he still says every once in a while, your favorite president.
He talks
about himself like that.
Yeah.
You know, this is a guy who needs everyone to love him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, pushes everybody away. I mean, he's a mixed up dude.
Well, yeah.
Seriously, I mean, mixed up dude.
Beyond everything else, he is just a weirdo. I mean, I have seen few people. I mean, there are a lot of iconoclasts out there who are just so bizarre and off the beaten path in terms of their behavior and how they carry themselves. I mean, everything that Donald Trump is, everything that he says, even his appearance, especially his appearance, are so strange. And even people like Jim Comey are like baffled when they see him in person. Like, what is this? What's going on with his hair? Why do his eyes look like that? Why is his tie too long? Why do his suits? I mean, he's a billionaire. Why do his suits not fit him? Well, he's not a billionaire, by the way. You know, that could be part of the problem. He's going to Joseph A. Bank and buying things off the rack or something like that. I don't know, or Nordstrom or something. Because
it's amazing with all of his downturns and losing close to $1 billion.
Yeah.
In the '90s.
Yeah.
I mean, how does he manage to live the way he does despite that? I mean, it's quite a mystery to me.
Yeah. I mean, he's just figured it out that perception is reality. And if he can keep just hammering the same points over and over again, I'm the greatest. This is the worst scandal in the history of American politics, of the American presidential harassment. He can say all these things over and over again, and people legitimately will start to believe him, because I think he understands that as president of the United States, people believe their president. And that's why George W. Bush was able to get away with no WMDs. This is why they were able to get away with torture. And this is why Donald Trump has been able to get away with 1,000 things every single day.
I mean, I think if he can lay claim to one being the best at one thing, it's probably the best con man in history.
Yeah, he is better than anyone else at turning his own pile of shit into, you know, a 100-story tall gold-plated building. I mean, that's what he's doing.
He's a master con man. He really is. He's a master of the art of the con.
Yeah.
And he's really good at it, obviously. He's the president.
Right, right.
And despite being a birther. I mean, it still blows my mind.
I know.
That we have a president who was a birther.
Yeah.
Good God.
Well, yeah, and again, with the economy the way it is, I think it's artificially propping him up. If it wasn't for what I think every fair-minded person believes is still the Obama economy keeping him afloat, if it wasn't for that, his approval numbers would be in the probably the mid-20s at this point. It's just people are really happy with jobs and so on. It, but still, they seem to be okay, contented enough to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, even though they probably shouldn't.
Yeah, you know, part of it is that economies take a long time to turn around. They're like battleships, And what he's doing is going to end up with seriously negative effects on the economy.
Yep.
Everyone who understands how this all works says this, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not just me. I'm an ignorant, know nothing about the economy, to be honest, but you know, I can read what other people have to say, and
sure.
I know that the actions he's taking are going to end up in a real downturn eventually.
Yeah.
And you know, and the problem is, because it takes so long for these effects to be noticed, it could be, you know, the last month of his term in office that this happens.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I hope
like it was with George Bush. You know,
yeah, I mean,
he went through two whole terms destroying the economy before it got bad enough.
Right, and then it happened at the worst possible time when John McCain's like, "God damn you, George W. Bush, why did you do this to me?"
Yeah.
But speaking of campaigns, are you keeping track of the Democratic presidential candidates, or do you think too soon?
Yeah, I am. You know, I mean, not really following it or believing much in the way of polls right now, but you know, I mean, I have some people that I like better than others. Yeah. I like Elizabeth Warren a lot.
Yeah, me
I have
too.
To be honest.
Yep.
And not that crazy about Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah. Interesting. What's your skepticism with regard to Mayor Pete?
Just seems a little bit milquetoasty.
Yeah.
You know, not really. For, you know, I didn't really like that he went on Fox News. I really didn't. I think that's a bad look for Democrats to do that now.
Yeah.
And I'd prefer. I know you said that you didn't really see anything wrong with it, but I think I disagree with you on that because, you know, for me, I see Fox News as a wholly malevolent force in the United States right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you on that.
And I really, what I think would be more effective would be if the Democratic candidates all kept a united front and mm-hmm. said, nope, we're not going to deal with Fox News. But when one or two of them go on and do it and pretend like it's some normal thing, you know, it destroys that whole impression, because then people can say, well, if it's so malevolent, how come Mayor Pete went on there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know what? I respect that point of view, and I understand that point of view, and in some ways, I agree with it. My only concern is that there needs to be some sort of avenue that we can constantly exploit to be able to crack that nut, to be able to get into that bubble and turn some heads. Because yeah. I think, you know, if we don't at least endeavor to try to change some minds, because even though they are Fox News viewers and they are what we think they are, there are a few who just do not know any better. Oh, it's the news. Let's just watch the news. And so
yeah,
that's what they're doing.
You're right.
Yeah. And at the same time, though, it's not the news. We know that even the hard news reporting on Fox News is chosen to pursue a certain agenda, where maybe the actual details of a story itself aren't necessarily spun to be pro-Trump or pro-conservative, but the actual choice of that news story suits an agenda. So
everything about it really is designed to be forward the right wing agenda, including the people like Shep Smith who are presenting a liberal sort of viewpoint. You know, I think he's the beard. He's what gives the rest of it credibility.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I'm glad it's him and not someone like Juan Williams or one of the other tomato cans, as they used to call them on
right.
Fox News, that just are there just so they can be the Washington Generals to like Jesse Waters' Harlem Globetrotters. You know what I mean? Like
right.
they're
yeah,
there
yeah.
just to take the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really pretty. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there are a few people who might be reached, but I'm not sure that that's going to happen by going on Fox News.
Yeah.
Just because everything you do. I mean, what happened was immediately after Mayor Pete went on there,
yeah.
you know, Tucker Carlson attacked him, and
that's true.
Sean Hannity attacked him, and it was like they didn't even blink at it. You know, they gave him no credibility for doing it, and they never will. What they're going to do is they're going to take that appearance and spin it to just keep their audience thoroughly brainwashed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What they're going to do is and if they haven't already, they're going to take clips out of context and they're going to selectively edit them like they always do. And it's going to be extraordinarily frustrating along those lines. And, you know, I unlike you, I think to a certain extent, I haven't really jumped in feet first with following the Democratic candidates yet, mainly because I feel like it's so early and we were through this meat grinder back in 2008 and then again in 2016, where it was this protracted and excruciating Democratic shovel fight. And it gets so frustrating after a while and gets so interminable after a while that you just go, oh my God, make it stop. And so I haven't really jumped in yet. And in fact, during some of my darkest hours, I go, you know what? I don't care who it is at this point. I just want the election to happen, and I want to see this guy defeated. At the same time, I'm so so skeptical about the veracity of the election that's coming up because of the Russian attack, which is not being mitigated by the commander in chief.
He's doing nothing about it. He's literally just sitting back and you know, just doing nothing on purpose because he thinks they're going to help him again.
Yeah.
It's really obvious.
And this is a whole new roadblock set up with Russia on top of all of the systemic problems that we have now with elections, whether it's lines that are just naturally too long or outright voter suppression, which is rampant across the country,
gerrymandering and whatever.
Yeah, you know, all the rest of it. It's just it's so discouraging and makes me it's really kind of stimulates my Gen X cynicism. You know, like, oh, I don't know, this just seems like it's not going to be on the level. So whatever, get someone in there now and let's get this over with. Let's rip the band-aid off.
I mean, honestly, I think one thing that might make it a little bit better this next time around is just that Trump is so horrible.
Yeah.
That anyone who has any kind of liberal views at all knows that this guy should not be president. And I think he's going to pull a lot of people out who might have otherwise stayed home if things weren't so bad.
Yeah. Well, he always makes things worse for himself. And now that he's completely untethered from any, you know, wise old men in the White House, they're just letting Trump be Trump. He is going to continue to undermine himself. And he's stepping right into his own propeller with this impeachment process because he's giving them more fuel every time he steps in front of a microphone or tweets or denies another subpoena. He's tempting more and more, like one more gigantic step toward an impeachment process.
I just saw yesterday that he's now decided he doesn't need a press secretary.
No, he doesn't need anyone except him.
He doesn't need a chief advisor. He doesn't need a anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all about Trump. He doesn't need any the rest of the government. He puts people in charge of agencies who want to destroy them and say so publicly.
Yeah.
Or people like
Ben Carson, yeah.
Ben Carson who are just idiots and don't give a shit and don't even study what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to ask you about that. Like, what the hell happened with Ben Carson yesterday?
There's something really wrong with that guy.
He's completely incompetent. I mean, I don't know how this guy was sticking his fingers into people's brain cavities and coming out looking golden and looking heroic out of that. Because I guess he's just a savant. Like, he's really good at that thing. And then everything else is just confusion and blurriness to him.
Or it could be, you know, onset of dementia or Alzheimer's or something too. I mean, because literally the way he looked at that hearing was
he just didn't care. Yeah,
it was like a confused old guy who just, you know, couldn't even bother to, you know.
I think he was stoned. I think he was high as a kite. I think he was smoking pot, and that's why he was thinking of Oreos.
That's possible too.
That's exactly what it was. I know if I had to go testify before Congress, I would probably have a little indica myself.
Well, remember, he's the one who thought that the pyramids were used to store grain.
That's right. <Yeah. laughs> Oh, I forgot about all the Ben Carter. The funny thing, I think it was just on MSNBC recently, Chris Hayes or someone played the clip of when they were having that one Republican debate in 2016 where there was some sort of log jam backstage where everyone was confused as to when they need to come out. And Ben Carson just froze like a deer in the headlights, and he just couldn't move.
That. Yeah, that was hilarious.
Donald Trump's kind of looping his way around him, and no one knows when it's time to go out. But I mean, the Ben Carson aspect of that was the funniest because he was just not going to move. He's just like, an absence of any direction as to what I'm supposed to do next. I am not going anywhere. I'm staying right here backstage.
Oh, this is one of the really bad things he's been doing, is putting people like this in charge of agencies.
Yeah.
And it's not even just the people in charge. I mean, he's replacing all kinds of levels of these agencies with right-wing functionaries.
Yeah.
You know, people who really don't care about what they're doing.
They're drowning government in the bathtub. They're doing what Grover Norquist has always sought to do, which is to, right. You know, to shrink government down small enough so that it both fits into someone's vagina and also can be drowned in the bathtub.
it's unfortunate, you know, and I don't know if Trump is doing this out of sheer incompetence or if he's being instructed to do it by, you know, whoever's behind him. But, I mean, it's really striking to see the sheer incompetence of the people that he's putting in charge. Really terrible.
Yeah, it's a little of both. I think it's born out of a lot of Trump ignorance, where he felt like, why do I need all these people? What's the point? I just get rid of them, and then we can save, you know, $1 million here or $1 million there. It's him micromanaging and
we don't even have a Secretary of Defense.
No, we don't, and we're about to go to war in Iran, for God's sake.
It's insane.
War in Asia without a Secretary of Defense. This what could possibly go wrong?
You asked about, you know, being as old as I am. Oh, poor me, so old. But,
suffice to say, you don't seem that old.
Well, one thing is this gives me a perspective because, mm-hmm. you know, I've been paying attention to politics for my whole life.
Yeah.
And I have never seen anything like this shit show.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's so bad. I mean, people who think this is in any way normal or acceptable, I will never understand that.
I know. I've been doing this for 30 years and I never thought it would come down to this. And my major concern is that that once this Trumpism is out into the world, like the Ebola virus, it's very, very difficult to pull it back in.
Yeah.
It's going to be very difficult to say, all right, Trumpism is over. Unless you do like with the Night King or whatever. You stab the Night King and all the rest of the White Walkers go away. They all drop to the
wish.
Book. Yeah, that would be great.
Nice. yeah, Victor totally. Orban and Marie Le Pen and all those people.
Kirk and Candace Owens and this new breed of whatever they are, these kids who are just nothing but trolls. I mean, it's really become down. I mean, the entire conservative movement has come down to one thing, and that is trolling. It's entirely driven by trolling, and it's led by the commander or the troll in chief in the White House. Oh man,
it's pretty. It's we're in a bad place right now.
Yeah. You know? Is it kind of motivating you to just drop it all and go back to session recording or something?
Yeah, well, it's occurred to me. Believe me.
do you ever have any inclination to go and just get a jam session going? Do you still do that? Do you still play?
I still play. I still work on music. You know, for myself. It's really. I'm kind of not into the whole. It's so much work.
Yeah, it
you
is.
You know, so much physical work. Just mm-hmm. you know, even to do it, it gets less and less attractive, and especially touring.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it's
I can't imagine
grueling.
Touring, yeah. All those music videos about how shitty it is to be on tour, I completely sympathize with that. It would be awful to, like, just disappear for 6 months and just hotel to hotel to hotel, hurry up and wait, you know, just maddening.
It plays havoc with your life in general, too, you know, because you can't keep friendships, relationships fall apart, all kinds mm-hmm. of stuff goes wrong because you're always gone, And also just, you know, it's very hard on you physically, you know, especially if you're on one of those tours where you're doing 5, 6, 7 gigs a week, you know, sometimes 2 in a day, and you got to get on a bus and travel overnight and you got to try to sleep on the bus and mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And it's just, you know, it's too hard. I don't really want to do that anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did one teeny tiny little comedy show with the Sexy Liberal comedy tour. And I went and I appeared at this event on stage and I was like the opening guy. And afterwards, and it was just down the road in Washington, D.C. I didn't even have to fly anywhere, but just being on stage for that period of time, interacting with people and then coming home, I felt like I ran a marathon. And it was just such a teeny tiny taste of that lifestyle in a barely applicable way. And I can't imagine doing that night after night where you're traveling and off and on airplanes and hotel rooms and just...
Yeah. Lately, I mean, you know, these days, nobody goes on airplanes. Bands don't travel on airplanes because you can't take your gear.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's almost impossible to ship gear on planes nowadays. And if you do it, it's really, really expensive.
Why? Because of the luggage rates?
Shipping rates are so high and, you know, but it's also, you know, people that these days, they use buses and semi-trucks to get all the gear, you know, because it's just a whole lot cheaper to do it that way. But it's much more hard on the people.
Well, Charles, it was such a pleasure to catch up with you again. And thank you for running the show on Little Green Footballs, carrying the episodes of the podcast over there.
Well, thank you, Bob.
I'm so grateful for all of your help on that front. And it's always great to catch up with you and find that we're still tracking together for the most part.
Yeah,
and
that's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad to see that you're still doing this and you're still strong on fighting Trump and making sure that your voice is out there, because we absolutely need you up on that wall as well as everyone else. So thank you for that.
You bet, man. And thank you for the same thing.
All right. We'll talk to you again real soon, my friend.
All right. Take it easy, Bo.
We'll see you. Bye-bye.
Bye.